The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
Everybody was excited about the Pfizer efficacy numbers, but we weren't so excited about the fact that it needed to be stored at minus 70, minus 80 degrees centigrade. The Moderna vaccine, because it can be stored at normal, achievable temperatures that don't pose a major logistical challenge, does make this prospect a little bit easier. It's still going to be daunting, but it is going to be something that is much less complicated when you don't have to think about freezer farms and trying to make sure that the cold chain remains intact.
The task force calls the spread of the virus aggressive and unrelenting.
At least 37 states have imposed new coronavirus restrictions in November. Here in Los Angeles County, restaurants and bars must now close at 10 p.m. starting Friday to slow the spread.
Amazon is shaking up the competition in the healthcare industry by launching a new online pharmacy. The service lets users buy their medications on their phones or other devices and have them delivered to their doorsteps in a couple of days. Amazon says it will offer discounts on prescription drugs for those who buy without insurance. The pharmacy will offer both brand name and generic drugs.
Luxurious Lake Tahoe has long been one of the most popular vacation destinations in the world. But almost as suddenly as COVID struck, its population pivoted.
We're seeing the busiest, most robust market Tahoe has ever experienced.
In the new work and school from anywhere culture, people are choosing to do that from the very spots where they generally vacation. Sales of homes in vacation towns are soaring nationwide, and Tahoe leads the list of the most popular choices, according to Redfin, a real estate brokerage. Sales there are up 80% compared with a year ago. The same in the area around Bridgeport, Connecticut, Bend, Oregon, Cape Cod, and the Jersey Shore. The transplants are generally coming from San Francisco, New York City, and Boston.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
1 week after Pfizer and BioNTech injected the market with the good news of its vaccine efficacy data, Moderna joined in as well this Monday with reports the interim phase 3 analysis showed 94.5% efficacy. Not to be outdone on the percentages, Pfizer and BioNTech concluded their phase 3 trial study with 95% efficacy and announced the news on Wednesday. By Friday, both companies were expected to file with the FDA for emergency use authorization. To get an idea on just how soon we could see the vaccine hit the market, Moderna's CEO on Monday told CNBC they could have about 100 million doses by the first quarter of 2021 and a billion by the end of the year. And that combines with Pfizer's projected 1.3 billion. So we expect to have some pretty good and decent coverage by the end of next year. And as it relates to COVID, the World Health Organization recommended against the use of Gilead Sciences' remdesivir. Overall, great news on the vaccine development front that has largely allowed bullish investors to disregard the onset of a major wave of COVID outbreaks across the country as it relates to the stock market. While stocks cooled off midweek on news New York planned to close down schools, it appears that the dips continue to be bought on Thursday with news that the Democratic and Republican senators would begin discussions again about stimulus. Let's talk about some of the economic data that has been coming in this week, none of which really moved the market tape because it's largely been improving for some time, but on balance shows the economy is on good footing. Looking at the Conference Board's leading economic index, that's Jim's favorite LEIs, let's start off there, showing that they've increased 0.7% in October, the sixth straight month of positive readings, with strength becoming more widespread within the index's components. Now, housing numbers continue to remain strong, shown by the NAHB's Housing Market Index, which hit an all-time high of 90 in November. Then there's the housing starts, were up 4.9% in October, driven by low rates and tight existing supply. Existing home sales increased 4.3% in October. And looking at manufacturing now, as we get some of the soft data here, how things are developing in November, starting to weaken a little bit, starting to decelerate. The Empire Manufacturing Survey dropped to 6.3 from 10.5, and the Philadelphia Fed Survey also decreased to 26.3 from 32.3. So a bit of a cooling off in manufacturing in those two regions. October retail sales were softer than expected, only up 0.3%, and September was revised slightly lower from an incredible growth rate of 1.9% down to 1.6%. And finally, industrial production was up 1.1% in October. Overall, like I said, we're still on very good footing, a little bit of deceleration. Now let's move on to more exciting earnings news. The lighter retail sales figure might have adversely affected the outcome to Walmart and Home Depot's better than expected earnings reports. So those two stocks took a bit of a cool off. Both were down on that news. And Ross Stores beat top and bottom line estimates with upside guidance and had a great response to that report in the stock price. The stock reacted very well on Friday. Lowe's only beat earnings estimates by 2 cents, and so the reaction wasn't as favorable as their blowout results were in the second quarter. The stock closed down about 8% on the day of their report. Now, it's possible that because that COVID has shifted in discretionary spending towards home projects, most of that has largely been baked in the cake for Lowe's, for Home Depot. If you look at Lowe's, their performance was up 33% for the year prior to that earnings announcement and drop of 8%. Finally, let's talk about the chip on my shoulder. That's the chip stocks. Taiwan Semi announced it was expanding production on Monday due to high demand, and that led the Philadelphia Semiconductor Index up 2.5%. Then Thursday, NVIDIA blew past estimates, which looking specifically at their data center revenue was great. Growth was up 162% over a year ago, and gaming revenue was up 37% from a year ago, helping their overall revenue growth at 56.8%. It's the highest growth rate for the company since the first quarter of 2018, helped by working from home, or maybe not working from home, and gaming from home. But it helped that they issued upside guidance too, but the stock was only able to finish up 46 cents on the day, possibly due to its rich valuation currently, and just overall stellar stock performance in 2020. Now, Cree Inc., that's C-R-E-E, Cree, which creates LED lights and other semiconductor products, got an upgrade on Thursday from J.P. Morgan. So a lot of good things were happening this week in semis. So that pretty much sums up the week. We had great vaccine information. Market cooled off after that and has been trading kind of sideways as a result of increased COVID outbreaks overall. New York closing down its schools is a negative sign. But overall, the economics have been solid and great, and the earnings report so far, again, great, but probably largely based already in a lot of those stock prices. That's it for this week's wrap-up report. We'll talk to you guys next week.
We're in a sovereign debt crisis, and it's huge. I keep telling people socialism is collapsing. People think, oh, no, I'm wrong, it's capitalism. No. They can't afford all these pensions for state employees. They can't afford to keep buying the debt without, you know, any limitation. This is what's collapsing. Their social programs, they need to borrow money to pay for them. But if they can't borrow, they can't pay. This is what the Great Reset is about.
If you want to listen to this full interview, just go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
If you're seeking financial advice and how to invest in today's markets, Financial Sense Wealth Management can help. From setting up or providing advice on 401k plans, managing corporate cash balances in a zero interest rate environment, to helping individuals, foundations, and businesses achieve their financial goals. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today at 888-486-3939. Let us work together to help you get on the path to success. Call now at 888-486-3939. Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow at financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, stocks have been sort of going sideways, hitting new highs, only to pull back. What lies ahead in our future, especially now, as many states go back into lockdown? Let's find out. Joining me on the program is David Keller. He's chief market strategist with Stock Charts. Dave, let's begin with the major indexes. We saw technology be a leader since the beginning of the year, but recently it's like the Dow Jones Industrial Average is powering ahead. Are we seeing a rotation here?
Absolutely. And Jim, it's so good to be back with you. I think that, you know, so many investors have gotten very comfortable with this long-term trend of technology outperformance, the NASDAQ performing very well, the FANG stocks holding up beautifully. And the long-term relative strength really speaks to, you know, the long-term uptrend that those stocks have been in. But if you look at the last, you know, 2 months, really, you've seen a rotation away from that trade, away from the technology, the communication services leadership that got us here, and an emergence, especially in the last 2 weeks, of some of the beaten down value areas, things like financials, energy certainly jumping higher on stronger oil prices. And that's matching things like industrials and materials, which had been actually performing pretty well sort of behind the scenes. So overall, I hate to declare the return of the value trade, but that's certainly the trend we've seen in the last couple of weeks for sure.
When you look at these sectors that have been beaten up, and especially energy, which looks like it's trying to break through its long-term moving averages, you have financials. The other thing I noticed too, Dave, for a period of time, we had consumer discretionary and consumer staples both rising at the same time. Usually you don't see that. One of them is, let's say, ahead of the other. Now it seems like staples are outperforming discretionary. So once again, is this reflecting that kind of value, that safety trade, or in your opinion, what's going on here?
It's a really great point. And one of my predecessors at Fidelity, this gentleman named Bill Doan, who ran the technical team there in the 70s and 80s, I ran it later in the 2000s. But he had this famous chart in our chart room, which was, you know, basically offense versus defense. And the indexes he used had kind of gotten out of date. So we ended up using consumer discretionary versus consumer staples as a proxy for what he had been using for decades. And it was essentially, as you suggested, looking at offense versus defense. And for the longest time, obviously, consumer discretionary has done much, much better. Now, when you look at that sector, you know, and just look at the sector indexes, you have to remember that Amazon is probably 25% of consumer discretionary. Home Depot is probably another 10, 12%. So two stocks make up a lion's share of the returns there. But having said that, it really spoke to the fact that, you know, investors were on one side of it. What you're suggesting is absolutely right, which is a bit of a rotation, especially on an equal weighted basis back to some of the consumer staples names. And I think part of that is sort of the coronavirus playbook. You know, there have been stretches here when it feels like things are ratcheting down a little bit, when it feels like we're going to be in our house sort of, you know, defensive against the world, you move to more defensive investments. So that means you go more toward the staples, the necessities, the, you know, things that are going to keep you going. What's interesting, though, is that's actually commingled right now with the work from home trade. Things like Zoom and Peloton, which had been doing really, really well, really pulled back in the last, 4 to 6 weeks. And potentially, given further lockdowns, you may see a return of strengthen some of those names as well.
Dave, does this change? I mean, we've heard news from Pfizer, Moderna, Johnson & Johnson. So let's say that we roll out a vaccine at the end of the year in the first quarter. Once this economy hopefully stabilizes and we get back to a normal economic lifespan, whatever that's going to look like, do you think we will see a rotation out of kind of like what I call the COVID stocks? You mentioned like the Peloton, the Zooms, more into traditional type sectors.
What investors should remember is that the market is a discounting mechanism, right? So the market is pricing in expectations. So when you saw the news from Pfizer, you know, last Monday, this most recent Monday, you saw the news from Moderna, really, you know, Sunday night into Monday morning, you see the futures jump, you see the market go higher. So, you know, certainly that's good news. Certainly that means stocks jump a little bit. But if you look, I think the more telling signal is what happens soon after that. I think at this point, investors have priced in that these biotech companies, pharmaceutical companies are working on, a coronavirus, a way to manage the coronavirus, a way to deal with it. There's potentially this gap between the news we're getting now, which is very encouraging, and the reality of when a vaccine is widely available. And, you know, we're here in Washington State and we're, you know, currently experiencing additional lockdowns than what we've had, you know, in the last couple months. So, you know, in the short term, things feel like things are getting worse. And I think there's a potentially a gap between good news we're getting now, which you know, speaks to what we're pricing it, but it feels like that optimism is already baked in by the fact that stocks have run so well up until this point. So I wouldn't be surprised if we have limited upside for stocks and more of a chopping around type of period. The second part of your question is what next? You know, what happens when a vaccine is widely available? What happens when we can travel again and we feel comfortable doing so, and things get, you know, quote unquote, back to normal, whatever that's going to look like. And I think that the way you ask the question, it has the answer embedded in it. It's whatever that's going to look like. I don't think we're ever going to return back to 100% where things were at, you know, a year ago, where I would, you know, my course of business involved traveling with a certain pace. It involved going to a lot of huge conferences. You know, I don't know how many huge conferences I'm probably going to want to go to in the next 12 months, but probably not many. And so I think there will be a process that with which we determine what that new reality is going to be. And I would say a lot of people have made life changes during this period with things like Peloton, with things like Zoom. I'm spending a lot of my time in Zoom meetings. I don't think I'm going to go to zero Zoom meetings, but it's going to be somewhere in the middle. And I think that's where things are going to become more stable. But some of those stocks, I think, that have done pretty well, some of that work from home trade, I think will be part of this new normal. And I think that's where investors should be looking at really the prices. Look at the charts and see what is working and what isn't. I think that'll tell you about what expectations are being priced in.
You know, it's amazing what COVID has done. In my opinion, it's already accelerated trends that were in place prior to COVID. For example, online shopping. A friend of mine owns a gym equipment company. They're commercial and home gyms, and their business has flipped. It used to be 70% commercial, 30% retail home. Now it's flipped. It's almost 70%. They can't keep anything they get on the personal side in stock. It comes in the door, goes out the other. I mean, it's absolutely amazing. And I don't know if you're listening to this podcast, if you've tried to go out and buy barbells, exercise bands, good luck. I mean, the price has doubled and tripled.
That's exactly right. And so again, the question is, you know, what happened? How do we evolve? And I would say some of what we've been doing has been temporary. And I tell you, the moment we can travel and feel safe to do so as a family, we're going to travel because we love it. And it's something we miss doing. And we're going to want to see family and all those things that we've been unable to do. But I think certain things, especially with, you know, when you think about the course of doing business, when I think about, you know, how comfortable it is now that I've spent a ton of time redesigning a home office, getting internet that's more stable, you know, going to an office and having a commute every day, I don't know how many people are going to feel comfortable doing that or interested in doing that. I think people have gotten comfortable working remotely. And I think all companies are going to deal with what does that mean for office space? What does that mean for expectations for, you know, productivity and being connected? And all of that, I think, will take time to sort of figure out going into next year for sure.
I was reading an article, even Walmart is pulling back from overseas. They're focusing more on their online business, which, you know, they're ideally set up because you can go online, order something on Walmart and go to your local store and pick it up, which gives them a little bit more advantage than, let's say, an Amazon. But a lot of companies are adapting to this. And as you mentioned, are we going to go back to gyms? Are we going to be going to movies every Friday night? I don't know. You know, we've got Netflix, even Hollywood released a movie, Tom Hanks movie. They released it on Apple TV. You could buy it, but it was a new release, and you got it on Apple TV, not the movie theater.
That's right. That's right. And so, you mentioned Walmart. That's a consumer staple stock, very, very near to another all-time high. I mean, it new 52-week high last week, and moving higher again today. So I think there are certainly charts that speak to that transition, and companies that are adapting well are certainly being rewarded. So what's good about it from an investment perspective is, even though I think upside may be limited for the broad markets, because again, there's just so much uncertainty, and you know, we're talking a lot about what could happen. I don't know what's going to happen with all of this, but I do know that there are stocks that are breaking out, and it's things like Walmart. It's things like hydrogen names like a Plug Power is doing well, you know, sort of clean energy names. There are stocks that are working even when the market is unable to break out. And I think if you focus on what is opportunistically building positive returns during an uncertain period, I think those are some really good long-term stories potentially.
Let's talk about the healthcare sector. In fact, it was recently released that Berkshire Hathaway took major positions in companies like Johnson & Johnson, Merck, and Pfizer, some of these companies that are coming out with the vaccine.
It's absolutely right. And I think that combined with, you know, Amazon Pharmacy and them competing on the pharmaceutical space, that's a new development just in the last week, which is not surprising. That's been, you know, talked about for years about where they would, you know, opportunistically look for other businesses. You know, that the healthcare space overall has been okay. I think the challenge from an investment perspective is healthcare stocks overall have not done incredibly well. If you look at Pfizer, gapped up beautifully with the news of the vaccine, that was the high watermark though in the last week and a half. It hasn't gotten anywhere near. I mean, it gapped up to almost $40 a share, and it's, you know, it's back around 36, you know, a week and a half later. And you've seen similar things with Merck's Johnson & Johnson, some of the other names that you mentioned. They've, you know, they sort of tried to break out, but really haven't followed through. And so I think the concern I would have for some of those is the long-term upside, the long-term possibility of a further upside. Biotechs are another general space, which can be very tricky because biotech stocks often have a binary outcome of sorts. They, especially smaller ones, they either shoot to the moon when they get good news on a drug, and then they can go to zero if they get negative news on a, you know, similar on the other side of that. The biotech index overall is decidedly sideways. Really since July, it's sort of chopped around. If you look at the IBB, which is a liquid biotech ETF, sort of sideways. So if you see those things break out, if you see them, you know, follow through to the upside, I think it could be very positive. But at this point, it's not getting anywhere near the upside that you're seeing in some of the other sectors we mentioned so far, even consumer staples, to be honest.
Let's talk about this trend that we've seen in the market, and specifically next year, 2021. Two things are on the horizon. We know that vaccines are going to be out there, so that's going to be positive for the economy. And secondly, we know sooner or later they're going to pass a massive stimulus program. You know, I've heard figures between $2 and $3 trillion. Let's talk about the impact on what that might imply for the market next year.
You've hit on some key points there. And I think the stimulus and whether or not we get one, when it's going to be, and what amount it's going to be and how that's going to impact, those are very much open questions. I undeniably that if, you know, a stimulus is announced, if it's rolled out in a way that's going to encourage, you know, consumers to spend more, that's going to be a positive, you know, it's going to be a tailwind for stocks by any stretch. And I think, to be honest with you, I think we have to combine that with what we were talking earlier. What are the patterns that we've seen from consumers? Where are they going to be, you know, allocating those funds? They're going to be spending them and where? And I think that's where you're going to see some continued upside. And honestly, it's things like Amazon and others that you mentioned, where Walmart and others, where people have been, you know, have been putting money. I think you're going to see additional upside with those types of names. I think the other, you know, the big theme going into next year, and this is related to the election when, you know, and again, the election's still not completely resolved, obviously, but, you know, I think when we were thinking about what would happen in a Biden victory scenario, what would happen in a Trump victory scenario, there are two buckets, certain stocks like clean energy that would do, you know, probably much better in a Biden presidency than a second Trump term. But there were consistent features of sort of their platforms or their way of talking about it. And both candidates related to stimulus, both candidates would want to invest in infrastructure and reopen the economy and boost things and encourage spending and encourage productivity. And so I think that was a consistent theme that pointed me to things like industrials, things like Honeywell and Caterpillar and railroads, Union Pacific. And all of those stocks overall are actually just in these nice, slow and steady uptrends. And so I think while we're seeing a lot of short-term upswings and downswings from some of the work-from-home names, things like Peloton, which were, you know, it's sort of feast or famine, did beautifully, and then all of a sudden come back to earth very quickly, you're seeing some nice, stable trends in some of the industrials and materials names. Dow Holdings would be another one in the materials sector. And I think that speaks to additional infrastructure into next year. And I think that's, you know, I mean, there are no guarantees in life, but if there is one thing that I would strongly assume would happen would be spending in infrastructure. That points to stability in those kind of names and further upside.
You know, the interesting thing about all of this with COVID in terms of how the markets reacted, if you take a look at how consumers have spent money, you know, a lot of the malls have been shut down, stores, restaurants. But, you know, I'm a sailor and I'm talking to the people I know in the sailing industry. They are selling every boat they can get. Same thing about RVs. I mean, it's like big ticket items, cars, which you would not expect. But I guess if you can't travel on an airplane or that isn't good, people are buying RVs and they're traveling by RV. I have a friend that has one. His RV has been in the shop for almost 6 weeks. I haven't been able to get service because of the demand. I mean, it's kind of strange the way things are going. In fact, what was it just came out this week? Housing starts or housing sales hit a 14-year high.
Exactly right.
And it's interesting. You talk about how what this is going to look like when we emerge from this. It's going to be different. I have clients and friends that are realtors, and they're saying the big thing now is home offices, movie theaters, home gyms. In other words, we're adapting to this work-at-home environment, and that's what people are looking for when they're shopping for homes.
You know, it's absolutely right. And I think you've not, you know, you could have imagined if you had known a year ago, there's going to be a huge, you know, global pandemic. It's going to limit your ability to travel, to leave your house. You may not be able to go to the grocery store and get what you want when you want. I would assume the market would be down and then go even further. And the resilience of the market, the fact that it's gone and round trip from February down to the March lows back to where we're at now, where we're, you know, testing at or near new highs even today, is incredible. And I think it goes to what you said. I don't think you've seen huge changes in the amount of spending. You've seen, it's a different characterization of it in terms of what people are spending on. And I think anecdotally, you know, we tend to travel a lot as a family with, you know, crazy fun trips we would come up with every spring and every summer. We've not been able to do any of that, but we've, you know, gone to like Gold Belly and have shipped Chicago deep dish pizzas out to Seattle so we can enjoy some pizza from a crazy place, or Bao, you know, some Chinese dumplings from New York. And those are not inexpensive items, but it's a way for us to adapt and, you know, have some fun and think about traveling when we're not able to do so. So we're still spending money. It's just, it's in a different form. And I think, again, if you look at the stocks that are working, you're seeing that playing out with stock prices and that recognition that spending is happening. Again, it's just, the character of it is different. And I think the same thing, when I look at the chart of the S&P and it's literally sideways for the last couple months, and you would think, well, that's a challenging period. There's no real upside. But if you look at, there are plenty of stocks that have been going higher. And on the other side, there are plenty of stocks that have been going lower. There are opportunities out there. It just might not be the park money in an index fund and watch it go up type of environment. It might be more of an opportunistic, let me see where the trends are leaning and let me lean into those trends. And I think overall investors can weather this period pretty well.
So as we conclude here, Dave, if you had fresh money to put to work, from your perspective, where should that money be put in place?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, three general things that I would think, the number one would be, you know, and again, I'm a trend follower. So in general, I'm going to want to follow trends that are working. And when I look at the charts that stand out, that have been working pretty well, it's things like industrials and materials. It's these long-term trends that are going to do well if there's additional infrastructure spending, if the economy restarts and continues to improve going into next year, which I think is likely to happen. Those stocks should continue to do well. So that's one bucket that I think makes a ton of sense. The second one I would argue would be things like financials, sort of this forgotten value trade that has been so out of favor for so long. And I don't think value is going to dramatically outperform growth for many, many years. But I do see that there are spaces like financials, even energy, that have jumped out from relatively low levels that have given you clear lines in the sand now. If you're looking at the chart and setting a stop, it's pretty straightforward to sort of find those opportunities. And so I think there are, with financials in particular, I think there are plenty of charts like JP Morgan that have gone from looking okay to looking, pretty decent in a relatively short period of time. And then the third one I would say would be those, those work from home stocks. Again, as a trend follower, I don't tend to buy things that are selling off. But I think when you look at things like Zoom and Peloton in particular, they rallied so dramatically to the upside. They've pulled back pretty quickly and to a pretty clear support levels, I think, in both cases. So I think it's reasonable to look for names like that and see this as a bit of an overreaction to the downside and a fair bet to see if they recover and continue further on.
All right. Well, listen, Dave, as we close, tell our listeners how they can follow you and the work that you guys do at Stock Charts. It's one of my favorite go-to charting programs. In fact, your market summary page, to me, is one of the best in the business because I can go to one screen and basically I call it a trip around the world. I can look at any index, international, domestic, sectors, bonds, stocks, currencies, just about everything.
I appreciate it, Jim. Yeah, this is always so much fun to chat with you about what we're seeing. Yeah, so stockcharts.com is the place to find our work, and we really focus on three things, and it's all built around empowering investors to make better decisions. The first one is tools, and providing the tools to analyze the markets. You mentioned the market dashboard as a way to just understand what's happening, build a good market awareness and understand what's working and what isn't. The second one is education. So giving you the greater understanding about what moves markets and how to be on the right side of things. And then finally, it's commentary. So people like me and others that provide comments on what we're seeing, give you a chance to look over our shoulder and look at the evidence that we're following. And we think that combination of those three things is pretty powerful and pretty unique. And for me in particular, on Stock Charts TV, I host our Closing Bell show every day after the close. So you can find that on the website as well.
All right. And the website is stockcharts.com. All one word, Stock Charts. Dave, thanks for joining us on the program. All the best. Happy holidays and stay safe.
Appreciate it, Jim. Be well.
Chris, I changed my mind because the mechanism changed. And that is the mechanism through which money is created has changed. And it's a change which most people haven't noticed because it's a rather technocratic answer I'm about to give you. But this is the technocratic answer, which is that the use of government credit guarantee programs provided to banks when they lend is the monetary revolution, is the mechanism change, which almost certainly ensures that we'll be much higher inflation going forward.
If you want to listen to this full interview, just go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Call Financial Sense Wealth Management to schedule an appointment with a portfolio manager at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities Incorporated. Member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
One of the events that have happened this year as a result of the pandemic is various industries have been hit by that. Think of travel, hotel, restaurants. Where is all of this going, especially now as the nation faces possible lockdowns again? Joining us on the program is Frank Holmes from U.S. Global. Frank, you sent me a couple charts, so let's begin with a couple of these, and let's talk about their implication. One was airline stocks after 9/11. Well, let's talk about the implication of that chart and what it might portend going forward here with this lockdown.
So what's really important, Jim, in the capital markets, the ecosystem, actually did something totally contrarian. It expanded. And what we saw and witnessed was these millennials that were used to experiencing the world, traveling all the time, all of a sudden were stuck at home. And they started becoming traders and investors. And they took that intellectual capital and what money they got received from the government and went mostly into the stock market. And data points have come and said more money has come from millennials discovering the stock market and technology and gold stocks, et cetera, than stock buybacks. It's a big, big number. And it's great because I believe it's important to get price discovery. And this ignites more investors coming in from institutions into different asset classes. And we saw that in particular with the JETS ETF. It quickly halved in February to going into March, and then it went from $35 million to $2.3 billion today. Unprecedented, and what took place was first millennials were coming in buying, and then larger institutions were coming in, and people that hedge funds that want to short American Airlines or Hawaiian Airlines, they would go short that airline and go long JETS ETF. So the ecosystem starts to expand with those daily flows that the daily volume goes from 35,000 to 3.5 million.
So is this, Frank, coming, the millennials coming in? We've heard a lot about Robinhood traders. Let's talk about that for a minute.
Yes, and very much the Robinhood event is important because it reminds me of the 90s when all of a sudden baby boomers discovered the stock market and technology stocks. And so what we're witnessing today is platforms like Acorn or you could say Robinhood, they've stimulated other major brokerage firms like TD Waterhouse like a year ago went to no commission trading. And that basically says that you can come in with $500 and all of a sudden be long an investment. And then technologies allow these companies to give fractals. That is one share of Apple without an outrageous commission, zero commission, but they know how to break it down and give you a fraction of that and give you a fraction of the dividend that you'd be receiving. That inspired, so the barriers entry, that really helped millennials to come in to discover this. And what's important for longer term is as the baby boomers at least basically expire over the next 30, 40 years, you're going to see a transfer of something like $10 trillion to millennials and Generation X. And then Y. So we're going to have this massive transfer of wealth. And it's so great that they've all of a sudden discovered the market. They discovered the airlines because they've gone back and back tested and seen that whenever there's been an economic macro crisis, 6 to 12 months later, the airlines are up between 80 and 120%. And that's the big play. So we went up over 50%, 60%. We corrected, and now we're getting ready for that next leg. Will it be the vaccine? We'll do it. Remember that Jetsy this time last year was $33, $35 a share, and it's in the 20 range here. So it still has lots of upside potential to it. And I think that's what you're getting more younger people speculating that the airlines have to turn.
So, Frank, when you take a look at what's going on right now and going forward, we have the vaccines coming out. There's Moderna, there's Pfizer, there's Johnson & Johnson. And then on top of that, some massive form of stimulus that could be coming out next year with, let's say, the Biden presidency. A lot of people are getting bullish on the stock market. What's your view?
Well, historically, that when you go into a presidential election and the market is up going into it, it carries on to the end of the year. So I think from that point of view, yes, stock market trades higher. I think B is that historically that when you have a Democrat president, a split Congress, and a conservative, a Republican Senate, it's the best balance of power for a great bull market. Best performance in stocks take place when you have those checks and balances in place.
So let's talk about what might transpire in this next decade. At least from our perspective, Frank, we see somewhat of an inflationary environment. When you take, for example, with the lockdowns and shutdowns that we're seeing, you're reducing services that are provided, you're reducing manufacturing output, but at the same time, you're giving people money to spend for those goods and services. How is that not inflationary?
Well, it is, and quite often I quote John Williams from Shadow Stats regarding the algorithm or the recipe, the model that was used to make a determination what is CPI that the government reports. If you go back to the 1980 calculation of what CPI is, and you applied it today, inflation is not 1.4%. It is running at 8%. So I do believe that inflation is greatly understated. Inflation in real estate in America is up 10% over the past 12 months. We see for housing, a new housing because of the virus is impacted the lumber, five lumber mills. So lumber prices are up 40%. I can go on with a whole list of things. Gas at the pump, it's up also. The crack spread is for the refineries has turned very positive. So there's lots of things to say inflation is much greater than what is being stated.
So when you look at this kind of environment that could be inflationary, what does that portend for, let's say, the stock market and the type of stocks that lead the market? Because if you look at the 00 decade, Frank, a lot of natural resource stocks led the markets, whether they were mining companies, gold companies, oil, commodities did really well in that kind of environment. Do you see that happening in this kind of environment?
Well, I see greater supply restrictions, and I think you have to go back and fly 50,000 feet and look at the Earth spinning. The G20 finance ministers and particular central bankers usually last a lot longer than the presidents or prime ministers of countries. So we have a club, and so I'm saying it's like OPEC cartel. They have regular meetings. And we go back to 2001, coming out of the Asian crisis, and started in 97, 98, Russia imploded and defaulted on sovereign debt. It takes about 4 years. So we saw 2001, 2002, that the G20 finance ministers and central bankers were consumed with global trade, synchronized global trade, drop tariffs, drop barriers to entry, make it easy. And we had this huge secular bull market in both stocks and emerging markets, and particular commodities. And after the crash of 2008-09, all of a sudden, this club became consumed with synchronized taxation and regulation. They call it harmonization of regulations and taxations, et cetera. But really, it was just a way to raise taxes all around the world. And what we're seeing today is a collective example of this theory called MMT, Modern Monetary Theory. And it's the idea of using the monetary system to flood money into your wallet or into corporations. And what we've witnessed here is the Federal Reserve has come in and have used ETFs. The Japanese have been doing it for a while, and the same thing is in Switzerland. But now all of a sudden, the Federal Reserve can't buy individual stocks, but they can buy ETFs. They started buying muni bonds to drive down the cost of capital rolling over with muni bonds. So interest rates fell in the U.S. in the spring, but the banks and everyone basically kept charging high rates and the cost of capital was up. So to come in to change that, they bought corporate bonds through ETFs that drove down bond yields for corporates and also drove down muni yields. And this will facilitate this huge boom we're seeing. So real assets will be the big beneficiary from it. And anything where you see infrastructure spending, will it get really implemented under the new administration? They always talk about this big infrastructure spend, but then the regulatory arm always seems to nullify it or stop it. Maybe on this turn, that this, like New York City needs $12 billion to upgrade their MTA, their Modern Transport Association, the subways and trains. So I think that we're going to see a great bull market. And I think that this idea of MMT being practiced by the G20 central bankers is only excessive money printing. And the smarter people are going to say, okay, that's what's happening. I have to buy real assets and I have to buy businesses that are growing their revenue. So picking stocks, you really have to focus, I think, on three things. Revenue last quarter over four quarters. Is it rising? Yes or no? And is cash flow last quarter aligned over four quarters, and is there free cash flow? Those stocks have been stellar performers. And now we're seeing the gold stocks in particular, which I track, they went positive in free cash flow yield for the first time in over a decade in March of this year. And this past quarter into September, they had record free cash flow. And if you bought just a basket of those stocks with revenue last quarter is above the average for four quarters, and cash flow is above four quarters, and it had free cash flow, those gold stocks crushed any GDXJ by a wide margin for 1 year, 3 year, 5 or 10 years. So that just tells me that the generalists are now buying gold stocks, but that's what they're looking for, Jim. They're looking for that growth in revenue and growth in cash flow and a free cash flow yield.
So, Frank, that would also imply that technology should do well going forward, because you take a look at, you know, the big FANG stocks. I mean, many of these companies are growing at double digits still.
Yes, and you've got to look at those food companies like Chipotle versus California Pizza Kitchens goes bankrupt, but Chipotle expands. The first mover advantage is look for, are they hiring people? That's very, very much a great precursor for growth. Amazon, at the beginning of this crisis that we're in 2020, announced hiring 100,000 people, and then another 100,000. Well, their stock has been on a tear. Zoom has been hiring people. So go and look for those industries which are looking for people to hire, and that's where growth is going to be. One of the things that I noticed today, it's off, but I remember during March and April, driving, and all the parking lots were empty in all the malls around the city of San Antonio. But Home Depot and Lowe's for us is just across the street was packed. Packed. So what? Everyone's stuck at home? They're renovating their homes. Well, guess what? Lowe's and Home Depot are hiring people, and their stocks have been on a tear.
So when you look at these kind of companies looking at revenue and also this inflationary environment, what does this imply for the bond market?
Well, it implies that they're going to do everything to keep rates low. Look at the 10-year government bonds. It's 0.87 today. Inflation's 1.4. Why would you ever buy a 10-year government bond to get a negative yield? I'd rather go buy Grand Columbia Gold stock because it has a monthly dividend yield that's substantially like 3%, which is much higher than what, and I get paid monthly than I'm going to get with a government bond. And I get that upside. So I think that the government's going to continue, Jim, to use MMT. It's going to be an important acronym that people will be using in the vocabulary for the next 4 years.
So given this, Frank, we talked about some of these producers who have a lower cost of production and a rising value for the price of gold. I mean, it's hard to believe, Frank, that a 1 ounce gold piece right now is almost worth $2,000. Who would have thought that 10, 20 years ago?
Yeah, but you know, I've always talked about this great love trade, Jim, and it's really important to appreciate the great love trade. And that is that more than 60% of the world's population give gold for love, and that's the bigger part of the underlying belly of demand for gold. And it's highly correlated to the GDP per capita. So when you say, okay, what does that mean? We go back 30 years ago, China and India, affectionately known as Chindia, which is 40% of the world's population, had a GDP per capita. China was less than $1,000. India was $1,000. Today, China is $15,000 and India is $7,000. So China's far outpaced them. But what we can see is that rising GDP per capita means they can buy more grams of gold for their loved ones. And that's something that we have witnessed. And we've also seen it for our Jets Airlines ETF prior to this crisis of 2020. Then last year in 2018 and 19, Chinese middle class were the biggest tourists in the world. Because their middle class had all of a sudden surpassed any other country. They were bigger than America. And this is a real shocker, but it gets lost in 1.4 billion people. But let's come back to China and India. 30 years ago, they were only 10% of the total gold demand in the world. Most of that was from India. Today, they are 53% of all gold demand. That correlates to rising GDP per capita in those two countries. Now you throw in Vietnam, you throw in Thailand, you throw in the Middle East, so it's important to recognize that gold itself is given for love, and jewelry is a very significant demand. Anytime it falls greatly, big corrections, all of a sudden that physical demand offtake.
So given this, if you had to put money to work right now, Frank, what looks good to you?
Always the 10% golden rule, Jim. Having a 10% weighting in gold and gold stocks is just wise and prudent. I'm 65, and there's a simple rule of thumb. Whatever your age is, should be focused on safe, high dividend paying stocks or short-term yields and bonds, very short-term, munis, etc. 35% should be long equities. And as you get older, it should be less taken off the table, taken off the table for short-term income. But when you're young, like these young millennials, well, guess what? 25 years old, that means that only 25% should be in short-term cash, 75% be for more speculative stocks. So I think it's a simple rule, Jim. As you get older, just recalibrate yourself each year that you have more in the short-term income and dividends and secure and safe dividends and less speculation.
All right. Well, listen, Frank, you're a prolific writer. If our listeners would like to follow your work and the things that you do at U.S. Global, why don't you tell them how they can do so?
USFunds.com, USFUNDS.com. Sign up for Frank Talk. There's the investor alert. And we produce this rich research every Friday. It's a team effort with the investment team of doing a SWOT analysis of the different asset classes. It could be China, Eastern Europe, domestic equities, tax-free, gold, airlines, and we try to make it comprehensive but succinct so that you can quickly scan through categories you're interested in. And my travels, wherever they are, if I'm today, I'm Zooming everywhere, but I'm still keeping in touch on a global basis.
All right. Well, listen, Frank, as always, it's a pleasure having you on the program. Stay safe and happy holidays.
Same with you, and have a wonderful Thanksgiving.
In the middle of this pandemic, it's hard to notice, but we are living through a really remarkable moment for science. This vaccine race for COVID, as well as the development of treatments, there's just incredible research going on in real time, but they're not injecting really a piece of the virus. They're doing something a little bit different. They're injecting some genetic material rather than a purified piece of the virus. And that has tremendous advantages in terms of speed. There's a reason that the Moderna vaccine and the Pfizer vaccines were the first to get going, and that's because this mRNA approach to vaccine design is much, much faster.
If you want to listen to this full interview, just go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button. Jim, we've been discussing the problems facing brick and mortar retail stores on Financial Sense NewsHour for years, particularly when it comes to smaller mom and pop retailers. And, you know, this isn't just from Amazon, which is extremely hard to compete with in terms of convenience, but also because there was a massive overbuilding of shopping malls and stores over the past couple decades, right at the very same time that e-commerce was starting to take off. This is something we've been discussing with Howard Davidowitz and other retail experts on our show for quite a while. You know, where does all of this stand now in light of COVID?
Well, I mean, let's put this in perspective. This year alone, it's estimated that over 8,300 stores will close. Now, Chris, that follows over 9,000 stores for 2019. So even before COVID hit this year, we were already in this process of store closings. This year, it's accelerated. And let me just give you an example. Taylor Brands closing 500 stores. RTW Retail, 378 stores. Sign Mart, 279 stores. GNC, 248 stores. Gap, 350. And I could just go on and on with the number of stores that are closing. And we'll get into why this isn't always the best strategy on the retail front. But it's not just stores closing, it's also bankruptcies. I mean, this year, Pier 1, J. Crew, Neiman Marcus, Stage Stores, JCPenney's, GNC, Lucky Brands, Brooks Brothers, one of my favorite retail stores, went bankrupt this year, Ann Taylor, Taylor Brands, Stein Mart. So it's not just store closings, it's also bankruptcies. And if you think about it, what our governors and mayors are doing is they're destroying and accelerating in many ways the digital economy, because you can't operate a business. We'll get into this when we talk about restaurants and service industries. But what this is doing and what the pandemic has done is accelerate a trend that was already in place. I mean, there were more store closings last year than there were this year. There was 9,300 store closings last year. It'll be 83 this year. So, Chris, before COVID, we were automatically doing this. And the other thing that you're doing, and this is rather interesting in terms of survival, a lot of stores are doing what they call going dark. And what they're doing is they're closing their stores to shoppers. And I'm going to give you an example. Macy's in Colorado closed two of its main stores to customers. You can't go in. You're not going to go in like a regular department store. What they've done is turn those department stores into fulfillment centers. And we're going to come back to this in terms of retail survival. So you can go to Macy's online, order your merchandise online, and then go to the store and pick it up. You can actually pick it up the same day. So there's advantages to having a brick and mortar presence. And look for Amazon to start buying a lot of these, let's say, bankrupt retail outlets that have these big stores. And now you have all this empty space. So Several stores are talking about closing their doors and turning their stores into fulfillment centers for Amazon, because one of the problems of online shopping, it's very, very expensive to fulfill online orders. There's not much of a profit margin. You think of Amazon as the world's largest store in the world, but Amazon makes most of its profit from cloud computing. It doesn't make it on the retail end. So a lot of stores are going to what they call going dark, and they're going to turn their stores into fulfillment centers. And we'll talk more about the shape of what retail is going to look like over the next decade.
You know, I just wonder how long before we do start to see drone deliveries, right? I mean, all of us are used to seeing the Amazon Prime trucks driving all over the place, dropping packages off. But how long before we just start seeing drones fly over with packages back and forth, crisscrossing the skies? I mean, I know that that is underway. Amazon has been testing this. I believe there are some select locations where they have actually delivered some packages. So it just seems to me now with COVID and 2020, gosh, you got to think outside the box here. Anything is now possible at this point.
Yeah. What the pandemic has done, it's basically speeding up this digital economy. For example, the Wall Street Journal did an article this week about consumers buying cars online. You've got Carvana. So, you know, you think of the traditional car dealer parking lot with cars on display. Today, you can just buy it online, pick it up and deliver. You take a look at groceries. You've got Amazon Fresh. You've got Walmart making grocery deliveries or even picking them up at the store. You can call up. They were talking about a lot of seniors are just calling in. They don't want to be inside the store. So they call Walmart and they say, hey, I need lettuce. I need milk. I need this. And then just show up the store at the delivery pickup section and pick up online orders. A lot of the department stores are doing the same, where they're getting rid of certain departments in the store and setting it up for online pickups. You take a look at what we're doing now with telemedicine. I mean, I just had my latest visit to the doctor was done online. Three quarters of Americans are trying new shopping methods as a result of the pandemic. Think of restaurants, curbside pickup, department stores, online pickup or curbside pickup. And then also take a look at how this is even pervaded into the fitness space, where you have, you know, everybody's heard of Peloton. So you have Peloton, you've got Tonal, you've got Tempo, you've got Mirror, you've got Nordic Track, which is coming out with their iFitness. So instead of going to a gym, you buy the gym equipment, you have it in your house, you have online training. Some of this stuff is quite sophisticated, like Tempo, which is you have a 42-inch touch screen, and you have a heart monitor, you have coaches, and you have artificial intelligence. So when you're doing your weightlifting exercises, Tempo's AI cameras will tell you whether you're doing the form correctly. Almost, Chris, like, you know, think of what it costs to have a personal trainer. I mean, when I started to work out, I hired a trainer. You know, there's 75, my last one was $125 an hour. Now I can get all that online with my Tonal or my Tempo. So all of this is transforming the way we are going to be shopping in the future. And it's just, quite honestly, all the pandemic did was an accelerate a trend that was already in place.
So as we started discussing at the beginning of this show today, you know, there's been more than 8,300 stores that are going to close in 2020 alone. This follows 9,300 store closing in 2019. This really is and has been a retail apocalypse. When you just look at the numbers, you may not notice it per se, but it's happening all around us. If you work in the retail industry, you definitely realize it. If you're sitting from the comfort of your home and ordering all your stuff on Amazon and taking, you know, occasional trips to the grocery store, well, you may not notice that there are stores closing up, boarding up their windows all over the place. A lot of them are, again, small mom and pop retailer stores that just can't compete in the highly competitive digital world that we now live in. But all that being said, it sounds like in light of this retail apocalypse that's going on, we're really saying that there is a, shall we call it a technological phoenix rising from the ashes that is highly disruptive, and that is honestly spurring retail in new and different ways to make the customer experience even better. These are some of the things that we need to keep in mind, I suppose, as investors when it comes to the disruption that's taking place in retail right now.
Sure. And this digital trend is only going to accelerate. And some of the things that you're going to see in the future, you're going to see a lot of companies go to more online digital events. I mean, I just watched the Apple presentation a little over a week ago on their new laptops. Instead of Steve Jobs Theater, where they would hold these events, it was held online. And so you're going to see stores do that, fashion events, things like that. Also, contactless payment methods, where you could do it with the phone. You're not going to have to carry your credit cards. Virtual try-on. And I want to get on to this topic because there are several apps right now, several companies that are selling clothing. You get the app, and this app will take and size your measurements, and then you order your things online. You're going to see this morph into your future stores. And what stores are trying to do is, how can we make this available? So reduce, let's say, trying products in the store. It'll be more of a digital online experience where you can have an in-depth look, sideways, three-dimensional look at the product that you're buying, and then also expanding curbside pickup. And let me talk about what you're going to see the store in the future. And this is coming with the digital age. So if you think of, you know, think of going to a store, whether you used to go to Sears, JCPenney's, you're going to a Nordstrom or a Macy's, you have 100,000 square feet on two or three floors of all this display space that are on shelves, they're on cabinets for display so you can look at it. What you're likely to see in the future is the department store is going to be about the third of the size of what it is now. And so instead of walking throughout this big 100,000 square foot display on several floors, you might walk in and you're going to see various kiosks. Okay, I'm looking for dress pants or a shirt or something. You go to a kiosk and you go through various merchandise items. You see things you like. You click on them, they go into a folder. Now you have things that you're interested in. You go into the digital dressing room where they will call up. You will look and face a mirror. And then what will happen is digitally they will put that item, whether it's a blouse, a shirt, a pair of pants, on you. And you'll say, hey, it looks good on me. I like that. Then what will happen is they will just go to the stocking shelves and they will get the item for you. So if you take a store, they will be smaller. The displays will be done more on kiosk, with the exception of shoes. I mean, it's kind of hard to buy a pair of shoes online. And then what will happen is more space will be devoted to inventory stocking so that they can carry more items in stock. So if you find something you like in your size, it's available. You're going to have more pickup, curbside pickup. I've seen this with Nordstrom's is doing this, devoting a section of the store for online pickup items. And what that does is it expands sort of the offerings that you could do. So you could still have the in-store experience, but it's going to be more looking at a kiosk than looking and picking up stuff. And then you also have curbside pickup. So the digital store in the future, digital dressing rooms, will require less space for display. So your Macy's or Nordstrom's in the future are likely to be much smaller, a third of the size of what they are. Now, what that entails, retail shopping centers are going to get smaller. Some of them are going to be transformed. We've read stories about a mall being turned into a community college. If you take a look at some of these giant malls and the space they occupy, they're talking about developers coming in, tearing down the mall and building these enclosed housing communities with housing, parks, a little strip center inside, and building communities. Another thing that they're going to be doing, and this is going to be more socialization, because as human beings, we are social
animals. And Chris, I'm thinking of one of the major shopping centers where we live in La Jolla. They took the center, they expanded it by 90 stores, and they built this socializing experience. They have plenty of areas to sit around. You can have lattes. There's more restaurants. There's movie theaters. So a lot of this, let's say the malls of the future, are going to be based more around socializing events. Because let's face it, shopping is kind of a social event. Some people like it. It's you're getting out of the house, you're going someplace. Because I don't think even post pandemic that we're going to want to spend our time staying indoors like we have now as a result of the pandemic. Digital growth and omni-channel solutions, online buying. Because one of the things you're going to see, and this will happen with Amazon, as I mentioned, online orders are very costly to fulfill. The stores that already have a brick-and-mortar presence, if they adapt it as Macy's is doing with its online presence, these are the stores that are going to be able to survive. That brick-and-mortar store is going to allow you, as a consumer, order your stuff online and pick it up that day. Go to the store instead of waiting for an Amazon truck. I've been doing a lot of Christmas shopping online. Some of the stuff is not going to get here for a couple weeks. And for the stuff I really wanted to make sure that I wanted to get, Chris, I actually went to the stores because I could see it, I could feel it, I could test it, and I could walk out with it. The brick-and-mortar store is not going to go away. It's just going to look differently. It's going to operate differently.
You know, Jim, it's funny when you're talking about some of these different things that we should expect to see, a lot of these kind of futuristic-sounding things, which are being implemented in select areas, and it's just a matter of time before they scale up. I was reminded of that one scene in Minority Report with Tom Cruise where he walks through a mall and basically the walls are all kind of like these virtual screens with AIs talking to them. And as people are walking through, it's automatically scanning their measurements, scanning their biometric information, and then targeting those ads or targeting the communication of those AIs to sell them things. It's pretty fascinating because it is kind of a look of how this could work in a retail experience. And it sounds like, you know, in some ways that they were onto something there.
Well, you may not realize it. It takes place right now. When you walk into a Nordstrom store or Macy's, you're on camera. They want to know, they follow your traffic pattern when you walk in the store. What displays do you go to? What do you gravitate towards so they can adjust that? And so, you know, taking biometric measurements when you walk through the store, I mean, that's the digital store. That's, you're likely to see more of that in the future. Now, let me talk about the good news, because everybody's been talking about the retail apocalypse. The good news is consumers are still spending. I mean, think of, you know, staying at home. You're not dining out. You're not traveling, getting on an airplane, going to some destination. All that money that you used to spend, you're saving. And that was one of the statistics that we saw with COVID, is the savings rate, not only with transfer payments from the government, whether it was PPP or unemployment or stimulus checks that were sent out, the savings rate went up because people were spending less and they got money that they were getting from the government in one form or another in a stimulus check. And it's amazing because people aren't traveling, but RV sales, Chris, have gone through the roof. I have a friend that has one. His RV's been in the shop for 6 weeks. And the reason is they've got so much business that they're doing, they can't keep the stuff on the lot. Boat sales have gone through the roof. Car sales have gone through the roof. So people are spending their money in different ways. They're still spending. So the money that was diverted from travel, dining out, hotels is now being spent buying big ticket items. So we're talking about apocalypse, but really what's coming out of this is transformation. As I mentioned, all the pandemic did was already accelerate a trend that was in place prior to the pandemic, and it's going to become more pronounced after this. And we'll be doing a show in the future of what life is going to look like after COVID. So picture what we used to do and the way we did it prior to February this year. It's going to look a little different when we come out of this, probably by the middle of next year, They just announced today that vaccines could be available starting next month. So it's remarkable when you consider they were talking about 18 months to get a vaccine. We're going to have a vaccine next month. They're going to start getting that out to people. Probably healthcare workers probably will get priority over others. But anyway, the good news is it's going to look different, but I think you're going to enjoy it.
Yeah, you know, on the vaccine front, too, it's pretty amazing. We spoke with an expert in this area, a biotechnology expert, and they were actually one of the first participants in the preliminary trials for the Moderna mRNA vaccine. It's a revolutionary technology. But one of the fascinating things about this new vaccine, it uses mRNA. This is both Pfizer and Moderna's approach. There are other approaches, depending on if you're talking about Johnson & Johnson, AstraZeneca, and some of the other ones. But in the case of mRNA, we see that they're actually inserting the genetic code for a part of the virus to produce the spike proteins. And it's a much more direct route. But even more important than just how effective they are, as many of you have already seen the news about it, 90% or 95% effectiveness, way above expectations. Even more important than that is that these same vaccines can be used to fight off and treat cancer in addition to other diseases. So we are really on the cusp of a revolutionary breakthrough in biotechnology. So there's some really interesting things that are coming from this.
As we conclude here, one of the things they talked about, how to be successful as a retailer, and they had three things they talked about: strengthen the brand differentiation and become authority in whatever it is that is in your retail space. So like if I'm camping, I'm going to go to REI. If I'm looking at getting gym shoes, running shoes, I go to Runner's World. And that experience, they're doing the same thing. The other thing they talked about, go on the offensive through omnichannel capabilities. So you just don't want to be brick and mortar. You also want to have a very, very strong online presence, tying that online buying experience with your brick and mortar store, and also create the intimacy with customers and the experience. And I thought about this, Chris. If you think about what we've seen with movie theaters over the last, probably two or three decades. Remember when VCRs came out, it was supposed to end movie theaters. Well, that didn't happen. It just represented another channel of which Hollywood can make money. They can make money at the box office selling you a movie ticket, but then maybe if you liked the movie, you bought the VCR or eventually DVD. And then, of course, now we have things like Netflix. So you're creating this experience. The movie theaters today have morphed into like very comfortable seats, kind of like home movie theater seats. They've brought in alcohol. They brought in restaurant food. So if you think about a movie theater, they make a lot of the money at that candy counter where you're buying your popcorn, your Coke. Well, now they're selling alcohol and they're selling food. So, you know, they've just created another profit experience and opportunity to make more money. And they've created a better experience. I mean, if you're going to go out to dinner, why not just sit in a nice, comfortable movie chair, a fold-out table to put your food on, have a glass of wine while you're watching the movie, just like you would at a home theater. So look for these experiences to become more intimate and also connect you with an experience. So it's not just shopping. It's the experience of shopping of wherever you're going to go, whether it's going to be a department store or even a movie theater. The one thing that out of all of this is you're going to see less commercial space. The shopping malls in the future, as I mentioned, the department stores will get smaller. They'll start using kiosks for display. So that means less cabinets, shelf space devoted for displaying the merchandise. You need to just display it on a kiosk, which allows you more space for inventory. So you'll have a front section of the store, which will be the kiosk, the back section of the store, which will be carrying the inventory. So brick and mortar is not going away. It's just going to shrink and get smaller. But I think you're going to like the transformation. It's going to be much, much different.
So, Jim, as always, if any of our listeners would like to get in touch with us and speak with any of our financial advisors about some of the things that we discuss and how we can assist them, what would be the best way to do so?
You can call us 888-486-3939, and one of our advisors will be glad to talk to you. In the meantime, on behalf of Chris Sheridan and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until we talk again, stay safe and have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.